Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How Legendary Copywriters Stack the Odds and Get Winners. It's an interview with former Boardroom Vice President Brian Kurtz. As the Vice President of Boardroom Inc., Brian Kurtz helped grow that direct marketing giant from about $3 million when he started to over $100 million over the course of his 25-year career. He worked with all the great copywriters and says there's a definite pattern legendary copywriters like Eugene Schwartz, Dick Benson, and Bill Jamie use to stack the odds in their favor and get winners almost every time. And in this audio interview, you'll hear what those things were and how you can model them and do them too. Brian says it's pretty much comes down to the list. Although copywriters don't usually have control over the list they're writing to, they do need to know how to handle and analyze and research them. Not only did the greats ask for a list history of any mailings they were about to work on, but they also asked to see control packages and promotions that got those lists in the first place. In other words, you need to know who the people are on your current list and what they've responded to in the past in order to write a new winner. Brian says from there, it's just a matter of becoming a slave to RFM, recency, frequency, and monetary, to see consistent results. And in this audio interview, you'll get an average Joe explanation of what all that means and how to do it. You'll also hear the two basic concepts every copywriter needs to understand, RFM and lifetime value, and how to make sure you've got them both down. You'll also learn why list managers try to hide things, the most common telltale sign to look for, and the five must-know questions to ask that will uncover the truth. You'll learn how direct marketing fits into online businesses and the one place it still has incredible power to get results. You'll learn why Brian says it's important to strike while the iron's hot, call the control, and pyramid up slowly, and a step-by-step look at how to do that in a mock campaign. You also get an insider secret of the five biggest name copywriters Boardroom used and what made each unique style a winner. You'll hear how Brian works as a consultant now. Hear the first thing he does for every client so he maximizes his time and theirs. You'll also learn about Brian's largest failures and the lessons he's learned from it about trusting press releases. You'll also learn the single biggest difference between a house list and an outside list and writing approaches needed for each. And you'll get a real-life insight into how Boardroom tests their copy and determines their controls. Look, never underestimate the power of copy, especially if you're looking at it as a science and not a game of chess. There are proven strategies that legendary copywriters use to stack the odds and gain the results they want. They analyze data and are constantly out to beat their own copy. And in this audio interview, you'll hear all about it, along with a look at Brian's amazing story and what it was like working all those years at Boardroom. Now let's get going. All right, well, look, welcome to the interview. I appreciate you taking the time to share a little information about yourself. You know, the big thing that I know of your name is you are the guy who worked with Marty Edelstein and helped build Boardroom, correct?
Correct.
So why don't you tell the listeners, what was your first involvement? How did you even step into that situation? And then we'll ask some questions of what it was like along the way. How did it all start?
It's not that earth-shattering a story, but basically when I was in college, I was the film critic for my school newspaper. So I was really into movies. I was into writing. To the chagrin of my parents, I was an English major, which means I probably wasn't going to get a job, but at least I was going to learn how to read and write. So when I got out of college, I started applying for jobs at publishing companies, went to a bunch of different headhunters that specialized in publishing more than anything else. I did get a job at a play publisher just out of school, and There was one particular headhunter, however, that for some reason he was like connected to Marty in a big way. And Marty was the kind of guy, and this will be a good preamble to who he was, but he was loyal to everybody that he ever worked with in his career. And so he was loyal to this one headhunter that kept on bringing him great people as he started building his company, Boardroom. And this is circa 1981, but this headhunter had been working with him since the mid-1970s when he started the company. So I got out of college in 1980. I was connected to this one headhunter. And one day the headhunter said to me, you know, there's this guy, Marty Edelstein, who I think would love you. And I'm thinking, I don't know where that's coming from, but why would this guy who I'd never met before love me? And I think what the headhunter recognized was that my personality was such that even though I thought I wanted to be a writer or an editor or something, he saw that I had an outgoing personality. I had kind of a sales component to my personality, even though I probably hadn't sold anything yet at that point in my life. But I was talkative. I was interested as opposed to interesting, because there wasn't much interesting about me at that point. All I had going for me was being interested. And one thing led to another, and eventually, while I was working at this first job, this headhunter connected me to Marty for an interview, and it was with some part of the company that was called List Management. And at that time, Boardroom managed its mailing list in-house. Most companies at the time would take their mailing list, give it to an outside list manager, and the list then would be available for direct mail people to use the list. And it just so happened that Boardroom managed this list in-house. Boardroom had newsletters, did not take advertising, so the only way to reach that audience was through this mailing list. And because Marty had built a newsletter business at that point to the tune of probably a $3 to $5 million business, the lists were probably the only way not only to get to the audience, but it was also a way for Marty to create some kind of advertising revenue of sorts. So it was something he kept close to the vest. He kept it in-house. And the job that I interviewed for was a salesperson renting the Boardroom mailing list.
Tell the listeners, how old was Boardroom at that time? What did the company look like at that point? What year are we talking about?
Yeah, so we're talking like 1981. The company had been around since 1972, so about 9 years. Company had one newsletter, Boardroom Reports. They just launched the second newsletter called Bottom Line Personal. They had a bunch of books, mostly business books, because Boardroom Reports was more a business newsletter. And it was probably about a $3 million business at the time.
How many subscribers?
I think Boardroom Reports at the time probably had 150,000. Not all paid. You know, it was sold with what they call a bill me offer, which a lot of people on the internet don't even know what I'm talking about when I say that. But back then, the newsletter business and the magazine business was very much try it before you buy it. So you get a bill me, you get 3 free issues, 6 free issues, you try it, you get a bill, and you actually get people to pay for it. So 160,000 subscribers, and Bottom Line Personal probably had just launched when I got there. So that had maybe 50,000 subscribers. And they had sold quite a few books. There was one book that was kind of a general business book called The Book of Business Knowledge, which actually sold about 100,000 copies, which was a lot for a hardcover book in direct mail at the time. So it was a growing company, you know, maybe 30 employees. And I probably didn't understand completely what I was stepping into, but what an adventure to start, to be able to be part of this company kind of at the beginning. Marty had taken his life savings to start the company in 1972 and saw something in me that he thought was congruent with what he wanted to build.
So you remember that interview the first day?
Well, the first interview wasn't with him. It was actually with the person who was running the whole list operation. It was after I was hired by her, and I had to talk her into hiring me because she thought I was overqualified for the job. And I said, well, I'm making $9,600 a year working for this other publisher. There's nothing that I'm overqualified for. And so for a $12,000 sales job in 1981, I had to, like, talk her into hiring me. But once I got hired, I got to meet with Marty. And I remember meeting with him in his office, basically saying, congratulations, thanks for joining us, I'm glad you're here. And I remember one of the things in his office that was so cool was that this was in Manhattan, in New York, and he was a black belt in karate, and he was a pretty strong guy. And one of the things he liked to do was rip phone books. And in the corner, there were all these ripped phone books. And I don't know if he had Manhattan, but he certainly had Queens and Brooklyn, which were big, thick phone books. I mean, we're not talking about one of these, you know, small suburban phone books. We're talking about major New York borough phone books. Yeah, I told him years later, I said, it's pretty intimidating coming into media the first time, and instead of having like a torture chamber, you've got ripped phone books from 3 million population of boroughs in New York City.
That's impressive.
I better not mess with this guy.
Did you ever see him rip one?
I did. It was pretty cool. I actually have a photograph of him karate chopping a board over a stack of books, which is one of my favorite photos of him. He was an eclectic character, for sure.
How'd he die?
January of 2001 is when he had a stroke. It was before 9/11. 9/11 was September of 2001. And he was paralyzed a bit on one of the sides of his body, but he didn't lose his mental faculties. But over the next 12 years, there was a demise in his physical and his mental capabilities. And so he died in 2013, and I think, you know, it was kind of like his body had just taken such a beating from the stroke. You know, it just kind of gave out. But I wouldn't say he died of any one thing. But he was strong as an ox before his stroke. So it was always a very difficult thing after he had the stroke, and he was limited in what he could do.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. All right, so what was your first job? You got hired on. What is it you were going
to
do?
I was actually the representative in the marketplace to rent the boardroom list. So the boardroom lists were lists of subscribers and book buyers to these newsletters and books, and they were all affluent executives. So it was a great list. It was people who, even if they only spent $29 or $39 for the product, they were affluent executives for the most part who were very responsive to direct mail. So everybody wanted the boardroom list.
And at that time, they weren't generating any list rental income when you came on.
No, that's not true. They had a list rental business when I got there.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. It was already doing $1.5 million just in list rental. We built it up to about $5 million in list rental at one point. And we ended up exchanging a lot of names. One of the beauties of that list, because it was so diverse in terms of who could use it, because the obvious people could use it, Money Magazine and all the health magazines and Rodale Books, Agora Publishing and Phillips, all those people could use the boardroom list. But then there were all these other people that could use it, like charitable fundraisers and political fundraisers and catalogers. So it was one of those magical mailing lists that would work for such a wide variety of offers because it was affluent executives who were very direct mail responsive. So the advantage for me was that I was representing these lists in the marketplace, and I got to meet everybody. I got to meet everyone who was involved in direct marketing in the world. From 1981 until I stopped selling the lists, it was not just the list brokers, but the mailers that were mailing the list. I got to meet a lot of them. And, of course, Marty was so well connected in the world with all the people that wrote for our publications that I got to meet some amazing authors and financial experts and health experts and just a phenomenal exposure to both the direct marketing industry and the publishing industry.
Now, tell me some stories. Who were you in awe of? You started out, were you prospecting to build the list rental business or generate additional sales for the list? Give me some names of some of the people you met that was just really impactful in your life.
There were so many. One would be Eugene Schwartz, author of Breakthrough Advertising and one of the greatest copywriters who ever lived, author of probably the most important book ever written on copy, creative, and human behavior, was someone who wrote the original promotion for Boardroom Reports for Marty back in 1972. And by the early 1980s, Gene was using a lot of boardroom lists for his small company, Instant Improvement. And I used to go have lunch with him on a regular basis because I would just sit at Gene's feet and just be in awe of all the things he could teach me. And the interesting thing is that I'd become an expert in the list business. And so not only was I able to arrange for him to use the boardroom lists in exchange for him to write copy for us, which was kind of a cool thing. I wrote a blog post about that called It's Not Always About the Money. And it was Gene Schwartz basically trading his copy for Boardroom for Boardroom's name so he could promote to our lists on exchange so he wouldn't have to pay for the lists. And what a great deal for both sides, because Gene had a small company, but being able to access lists like Boardroom and Rodale in exchange for copy was kind of a really cool deal. But in exchange, also, I helped Gene a lot because I became a list expert, and I was able to help him with relationships in the list industry where he could get other people's lists, and I could negotiate on his behalf, even do third-party exchange agreements so that he could use the balance he owed Boardroom, and Boardroom would owe someone else, and I could get him names at a lower price so that I would get basically great lists for Gene as a favor almost in exchange for him just mentoring me and helping Boardroom with copy. So that's one just amazing symbiotic relationship. To be able to call Gene Schwartz a mentor was pretty amazing.
That's very
Another
cool.
Another one is Dick Benson. Dick Benson was probably the most important person in direct mail at the time. I mean, he wrote the best book on the topic called Secrets of Successful Direct Mail. And Dick had his own company that published newsletters, that published the Johns Hopkins Wellness Letter and the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. And basically, Dick was a consultant for Boardroom. Once I started getting out of just lists and I started working on the marketing side at Boardroom, I would visit with Dick. I would go over all the testing we were doing. You sit at his feet, again, all day long, and he would just tell you what to test, what you tested that made sense, what you tested that didn't make sense. And then at the end of those sessions, one of the greatest compliments he ever paid me was I was helping him with his list because I knew a lot about the health list market. So for his own business, I was helping him with his list just like I did with Gene. And I remember him telling me how impressed he was with my list knowledge. My joke is that I probably could have died then and had a successful career with Dick Benson telling me that he was impressed with me. And he didn't say it with a lot of effusive praise because that wasn't Dick Benson's style. But he says, Brian, I haven't known you that long, but frankly, I'm impressed. And it's like, wow.
And so Dick Benson was primarily a copywriter?
No. Dick was one of the greatest direct mail consultants of all time. He created his own products with these health newsletters, and he also did consult. In fact, one of the consultant clients he's had was Contest Newsletter, which was one of the few newsletters that got to 1 million subscribers. And he was the chief consultant to orchestrate all of that. In this book, he has a lot of case histories. He was one of the architects at American Heritage Publishing. I mean, Dick Benson was one of the greats of all time as it pertains to direct mail.
Take me back to the very first letter that Schwartz wrote for Marty Edelston. What kind of results did that promotion generate? Do you have any idea?
I don't have the exact numbers. I mean, I remember it launched the publication. It was a classic headline. It was something like read 300 business magazines in 30 minutes and get the guts of each one. Marty invented hypertext 25 years before the internet.
What's hypertext?
Basically, he invented being able to get the summarized information of any of the most important things ever written. Maybe a better analogy would be he was the Reader's Digest before Reader's Digest understood what Reader's Digest really was. Even though Reader's Digest came before him, when it came to business information, Marty understood that every great business book probably had one great chapter or one great tidbit or maybe five great pieces in it, and those are the ones that we published in Boardroom Report.
That was launched back in 72?
Correct.
How many promotions did Schwartz write for Boardroom over the years?
Oh, many promotions. Well, he launched Boardroom Reports, but then later on he wrote much more in the health area for us. He had his own company called Instant Improvement, and he did mostly health books for that. So when we had a new health book, we would go to Gene and have him write copy. Interestingly, there's a phrase about Gene Schwartz that says Gene didn't write copy, he assembled it. What that means is that when Gene would come to us and we'd say we have this health book we'd like him to do a package for, he would take a look at the book and go, well, you know, I could write some interesting copy about these particular items, but if you had some information about X, Y, or Z as it pertains to either diabetes or blood pressure or whatever, if you could get some information on that and I'm able to write certain things, he would actually send us back to the editors and say, go do some research on these particular topics, so that we then would go back to Gene with new copy for the book that he would then write promotion copy for. Gene was also someone who wrote in what we call fascinations, or called bullet points, or basically an item with a page number. That was Gene's style, that he would have a tidbit that would be so enticing, and then you'd have a page number after it, and that would be where the answer to what his fascination was actually appeared in the book.
I thought that was Mel Martin's deal.
No, Mel was our guy exclusively. Actually, Mel learned that technique, he said, from Ralph Ginsberg, believe it or not. And Ralph and Gene were contemporaries in the 1960s. So I don't know who invented fascinations. I mean, Mel Martin perfected it with Boardroom and in Boardroom's copy, but Gene was on it even before that.
Who came first, Mel Martin or Schwartz?
I'm going to say Gene came first. but Mel became the master of fascinations for Boardroom.
How many other copywriters did Boardroom use other than Mel and Schwartz at that time, maybe in between 72 and 81?
I'm going to go 72 to maybe late 80s. We used all the greats. We used Gary Bensavenga. We used Jim Rutz. We use Bill Jamie.
Can we just say something unique about each one of these copywriters? A lot of my subscribers have heard of a lot of these guys. What could you say about Bill Jamie? And I've got a product of copy. What was unique about him?
Yeah, I did a product of his. I have something called the Bill Jamie Collection, which
yes.
I own the rights to.
I must have bought it from you then.
Yeah, that's the one. This is a $400 product, which I currently own. Bill Jamie's specialty was what I call narrative copy. He wasn't a fascination writer, although his headlines were just incredible. And he was a specialist. One of those areas that he was sort of the person that no one could beat was in the magazine world. He was fantastic at taking magazines that people kind of knew already from the newsstand and creating a mystery about them that other writers couldn't seem to capture. And most other writers, when they were writing about magazines that people already knew, they would sell more on price. They would say that we'll give you a special deal because everybody knows the magazine already. And Bill never really wanted to do that. Bill wanted to kind of create what's the mystery behind Money Magazine. I mean, his classic package for Psychology Today, do you close the door when you're in the bathroom and you're home alone? It's not those exact words.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yes, that was a classic Bill Jamie. There was one where he did, it was for New Yorker magazine, and it was like three sound effects, like drop, kerplunk, or something. It had raindrops on it. And it was just like he was tapped into the emotions in a way that most writers of the time did not. He wasn't as hard-hitting as a Gene Schwartz or a Mel Martin. He wasn't paranoid. He wasn't making the reader feel like it's information they can't live without. He was actually much more about entertainment and a phenomenal writer.
Anyone interested in learning more about him, you offer that package. What's it called?
The Bill Jamie Collection. Yeah, people could buy it from me. I'll give them a pretty attractive price on it if they're interested in it.
And it's a compilation of all of his work.
It's 10 CDs. It's every package he ever wrote on PDF. And then there's a DVD in that set of Bill Jamie himself presenting at an event that we did with him. It's 11 discs, like I think it's 10 CDs and a DVD of Bill Jamie's greatest, basically.
Yeah, it's quite comprehensive. It's excellent.
Yeah, it's really good. So, yeah, I mean, I'll give you an email for people to send. They want to send me an email. I mean, it's briankurtz1@gmail.com.
He teamed up with a designer, is that correct?
Yeah, he lived with them. They were actually partners. His name is Heikki Ratalahti. And, in fact, when Bill died, it was Heikki that made the deal with Marty and I to give us Bill's entire collection of direct mail. And Heikki was a very, very talented designer.
Okay, so we're talking about direct mail. How important, say in a percentage, is the design? What would you tell someone who's designing direct mail as far as the design aspects?
Good question. If I had to put a gun to my head and put a percentage on it, I mean, I still think it's like 80-20 copy to design in direct mail. I think there are designers that would probably say it's 50-50 because they're designers. And there might be writers who will say it's 90-10. So maybe it's 75-25. I don't know. But the big thing I'd want to say is I think without really good design and a designer working in concert with a great copywriter, I don't think your direct mail has as good a chance to becoming one of the great controls of all time like we had. So every one of our great copywriters worked with a great designer, and they were in sync. It wasn't like the copy came in from the copywriter and Marty and I would then just send it to any designer of our choosing. We'd actually have the copywriter choose their designer. They would do the copy. They'd be talking to the designer throughout. And then once the copy was done, they were working together on it once the copywriter gave the copy to the designer as opposed to us deciding who the designer should be. I probably would make this statement. I think that as time has gone on, I think design is getting more and more important, especially on the Internet. And in fact, I heard from somebody who's a marketer who I really, really respect, who does mostly online products. And he was at a conference speaking once, and he said his creative department were 10 people. It used to be 7 copywriters and 3 designers, and now it's 3 copywriters and 7 designers. I didn't take that comment lightly because I trust the guy who said it. So I think design is just critically important, because if people aren't going to be engaged with the copy, there's no chance they're going to read it. But then again, obviously I'm a slave to great copy is great copy, and that to think that because email is cheap or because the internet is less expensive to market on, that you can just throw any copy up there and it's okay. I think that there's incredible leverage in creating world-class copy.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Tell me a story about Jim Rutz and maybe one of his biggest successes with Boardroom.
He had a few of them. I was just in Arizona a couple of weeks ago, and I had lunch with his sister. And after Jim passed away, I wrote a blog post called The Copywriter Closest to God. And Jim was such an interesting man. In fact, well, first of all, his sister sent me his entire swipe file, so I have it all in two boxes in storage, and I have to figure out a way to create a product from it.
How many years did he write for?
Oh, God, he had to be over 20, 25 years, I would think.
How did he die?
He had a bunch of mini-strokes over the last couple of years, so I think ultimately it was high blood pressure and probably a stroke that killed him.
All right, tell me about a big win.
So I've got a bunch of big wins. But, you know, one of the things I talked about in that blog post was this notion that he was able to write for traditional direct mail, but he was also able to launch a church. You know, he had this thing called the Open Church that he created, and it was kind of the love of his life. And so he would actually write promotion that would bring in people to this Open Church, which selling religion is hard. And he did it in a spectacular way. One of his other favorite things that he did, there's that one, there's another one that I want to tell you about, and then there's a third that I'll do for Boardroom. But there was another one that he did where he was actually looking for a mail order bride. He hadn't been married, and he wanted to find a bride. And he went on various sites, and he wrote this incredible letter. I think the headline was something like, Wanted, Damsel in Distress, Distress Optional. Just a brilliant profile of Jim as a knight in shining armor that never found the love of his life. And just for a guy that had written promotion copy for newsletters and books and information products his whole life, to do amazing promotion for both a church and then for his own love life was pretty amazing.
Did he find a bride?
He never got married. He did have a woman from Russia that I think he came really close to marrying, but I don't know what happened.
I wonder if that influenced Gary Halbert when he wrote that huge full-page ad in one of the L.A. newspapers.
Well, they were influenced by each other, I know that. So Rutz wrote in the same era as Gary Halbert, and I'm a huge student of Halbert as well. And so they knew each other, and, you know, the whole dating scene, I have a feeling in this particular case, Rutz might have been influenced more by Halbert, because Halbert was the guy that, you know, you remember later on with Evan Pagan and the David DeAngelo stuff, and I think Evan was very much influenced by Gary Halbert. So I don't know where the origins are and all that.
So you get the church, the dating ad, and then you're going to tell me.
So as far as with Boardroom, I mean, he did a package once. I guess it was right at the beginning of Bill Clinton's first administration, and Hillary was, I guess, working for health reform. And there was this package that was almost cartoony. Actually, there's two. There's one where Hillary is on the cover, and it was like Hillary milking the system or something like that. She was pulling these udders of these cows, and it was almost like on the border of cheesy. And it was so powerful, and a narrative that I remember Paris Lampropoulos, one of the great copywriters that we work with later on, said that this is the kind of package that you could look at all day long and you'd never be able to imitate it, that Jim Rutz was so hard to imitate. And then there was another package similar to that that he did for us for Bottom Line Personal, which is our consumer newsletter. And again, it bordered on cheesy. It was something like Champagne Sherry and Limo Larry. And he had this fictitious couple about how they lived on champagne and caviar and had big cars and big houses. And I'm thinking, this is never going to work to our audience, which has a lot of people. They are aspirational, but I just didn't think it was going to work. But the way he finessed the copy to really get into the heads of people who were aspirational without making them feel bad by looking at people who were living with the rich and famous was just so artistic the way he wrote that. And so the beauty of Jim Rutz is that he had his finger on the pulse of what was happening in the world at every single moment. And he's a great example, as is Gene Schwartz. the power of reading everything, of knowing what's happening in the world, knowing current events, and not being a slave to current events in your copy, because you don't want to be stuck on something that you're going to have to revise as the world changes, but to be so in tune with what's happening in the world so that you could write copy that would resonate with a much wider audience based on their fears, their desires, what's happening in the world. So the Hillary package with people worried about the future of healthcare, Limo Larry and Champagne Sherry, because at that point we were talking about the wealth gap back then. This is probably in the late 1980s or early 90s. And we were talking about the same wealth gap that we're talking about today. And Jim had his finger on the pulse of that. He did a package for our tax newsletter. And again, he just understood that it wasn't that Americans shouldn't pay taxes, but you should only pay what was right. I guess he was a libertarian for the most part. And so he was so committed to both capitalism but also fairness that came through in his copy all the time.
Tell me the story about Gary Benzavinga. When did y'all first bring him on? What did he work on? And tell me about a big win from him.
Man, he had some huge ones for us. I mean, Gary is probably the best living copywriter, and I had the privilege of having him speak probably for the last time at my Titans event, which was one of the thrills of my career. And, of course, attending the Benzavinga 100 in the mid-2000s was also probably the event of all time for copywriters. I guess the beauty of Gary Benzavinga, I talk about this when I talk about Gary, is that he was the kind of guy that he would rather beat himself than get beat. And every copywriter that's been great in my life that I've worked with, and I've worked with all the greats, their attitude is that if they write a control, they get a package that becomes the control package, and it's a winner, the first thing they want to do is beat it, as opposed to sit there and rest on their laurels and wait for one of the other great writers to beat them. And Gary was like that. I remember there was one winner he had for us. It was a survey package, and it was kind of a mock survey where it was like a package for Bottom Line Personal where it was, we'd like your opinion, and please give us an answer to a couple of questions. And then it was a gift certificate for a free trial subscription to Bottom Line Personal. So it was sort of like the survey was an involvement device to get them into a free trial subscription. A little gimmicky, not low integrity, and not a scam by any means, but certainly a mechanism that got a very, very high front-end response because people love surveys, they love being involved, so it was a great involvement device the way he did it because he talked to people, we'd like your opinion as if you're part of our family at Bottom Line. So he really got under the skin of people who were already customers, and then at the same time, they were mostly ex-buyers to the publication, and got them to get re-up for a trial subscription. And so when that became the control, he said, you know, Brian, I'm getting this incredible response rate, but the payup isn't that high, meaning that a lot of people were trying it because of the gimmick, but by the time they got their first three free issues, a lot of them weren't paying up for it. So then they would fall off the list because we didn't get them to pay. So then he went the complete opposite to test against that, and he tested what we call a book-a-log. And a book-a-log at the time, and they still are out there, and I think the first one he did for us was 64 pages of copy. Almost like a little 6x9, it almost looks like a little digest booklet. And it was heavy copy. You know, the survey package that he did was very, very sparse with copy. It was a simple number 10 envelope with a very, very simple letter. And the book-a-log was the exact opposite, 64 pages, engaging, lots of stake, like we gave away some of the secrets, and then you got 5 of the 7 secrets, and to get the other 2, you had to get the free premium. So it was both a sizzle and steak type of thing. And what happened with the book-a-log to the same audience, we got a much lower front-end response, meaning that we didn't get as high a front-end response rate to the trial subscription, but the pay-up rate almost doubled, meaning that the engagement level with a book-a-log of people reading at that deeper level got us a much more qualified potential subscriber, and therefore once they got the free issues, they were already wedded to the product in a much deeper way than the people who went to the survey package. So to give you real numbers, like the survey package sometimes did a 4% front-end response, but we'd get 20% of them to pay up, whereas the book-a-log package might only do 2.5% front-end, but we would get sometimes 50% of the people to pay up. And when you think about that, it's not just the pay up and the money, but then the amount of free issues you gave away and didn't get a paid subscriber went way down. And if you looked out to year two in terms of the renewals, the people who came in from the Bookalog, they renewed at a much higher rate because they were wedded to the product initially at such a deeper level that after getting it for a year, they were actually doubly wedded, if I might use that phrase. Whereas if they came in from the survey package, even if they paid for it, they did not renew at as high a rate. So the beauty there that Gary understood is that he really understood lifetime value as it pertained to the copy that you write. And I always like to say is how you promote is how they will respond and how they will pay you and how they will renew. And so copywriters who are listening to this and people who are marketers who are hiring copywriters, never underestimate the power of the level of copy that you're putting out there for the initial acquisition package and how engaging it can be in terms of not just the first sale, but the second sale and the third sale.
Now, that's impactful. Did these guys all know each other? Did they talk with each other, or did they view each other as competitors? What was it like, the atmosphere?
No, they were competitors, sure, but they were incredible admirers of each other. In fact, Gary and Jim Rutz were friendly competitors. In fact, the two of them, I don't think they ever got together on this, but they both were the fathers of the Magalog, which was the 8.5 by 11 type of format that was a direct mail format. There's another guy named Dick Sanders who was an early Magalog writer as well. But the beauty of Rutz and Bensavenga is that they perfected the Magalog and they got control packages from it. And they also were so good that they were also in sync on the fact that for the biggest mailers they work with, they didn't even have to charge an upfront fee, that they would work completely for free, and it would be completely a royalty-based situation where they would get paid on names mailed. Now, later on, they became in such high demand that they would get an upfront and a royalty.
But at first, Rutz and Gary Bensavenga would offer their services free and just earn their income on a royalty?
Yeah, they did. They did very early on before they were as well-known and as in demand. But they also still were making huge amounts of money because they were the best writers. Those are the two that could demand that. I also think that they set the stage for the way copywriters are today. You know, when I did my Titans event, Gary Bensavenga spoke, and then after Gary Bensavenga spoke, I did a panel of what I call my Mount Rushmore of boardrooms copywriters of the last 20 years, and I put on stage four writers who were responsible for 650 million pieces of direct mail just for boardroom.
All right, who were they?
Those four guys were Paris Lampropoulos, David Deutsch, Eric Betwell, and Arthur Johnson. And while all four of them had not met each other each until that moment when they were on stage, it so happened that David Deutsch and Paris Lampropoulos were very, very close friends. Eric and Arthur were admirers of each other. Arthur used to, like, read Paris and David's copy all the time to get ideas. Paris would tell me that when he would want to write a package for us and look at the control from Arthur, if he thought he couldn't beat it, he wouldn't even take the assignment. So they were competitors, but incredible admirers. And in fact, in some cases, I think some of them over the years, not just those four, but others as well, would actually compare notes on copy. Like one of them would kind of coach the other and they'd reverse that. So I don't know who did this with who, but they were kind of helping each other, copy chief, so to speak. And I know that a lot of them were mentored. Like Jim Rutz mentored David Deutsch. And one of the packages we did with Jim Rutz on our tax newsletter, when we were going back and forth with them, with Jim, Jim said, you know, my apprentice, David Deutsch, wrote this particular piece of the package. So then we started a relationship with David directly because of that. Jim was fine with that.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. I know David, and let's talk a little bit about David. What is his specialty? Where are his strengths in relationship to copy?
David's an amazing copywriter, but David's an amazing teacher as well. I mean, I've seen him train and teach a lot of copywriters who are just coming into their own today that would probably give David as their mentor. And David's big thing is that, you know, he's so meticulous about his copy and how he writes headlines, and he's got his own methodology of how he creates copy, but he is just a master at finessing the words. Like, I've seen him just reword things that seem so simple that change the essence of a package.
He said Benzavinga, when he would get in control, he wouldn't stop there. He would maybe come back in, guys, and try and beat the control. So his incentive to beat the control were larger royalties.
Correct. So that if he gets the control, he's got the winner, so he's going to get the control, he's going to get the royalties. If someone beats him, he's going to lose his royalties. So there was always that incentive. And that's why I always warn against writers. I mean, they have to be good enough to get royalties in the first place. But once they're good enough to get royalties, for them to not want royalties and to not want to get paid on performance, to me is a sign that they're not willing, possibly, to put their stuff out there, you know, and to constantly try to beat themselves.
So how does one get the control? When you gave the examples of you don't have to pay to subscribe, so you order free, you hope that there's a payout at the end. Who wins the control? The one who brings the most money in?
Always.
So it's always about the money. And how long does it take to determine?
It could take 3-4 months to call a control from a mail day. Online, you can do it, obviously, a lot faster with a cash up front. Or in direct mail with a cash up front, you can determine it in a pretty short time as well. You know, you can win on front end and lose on back end, but for us, because we had a bill me offer, it always had to be based on P&L.
All right, so let's say I'm a hotshot copywriter and you like my stuff and Boardroom accepts me to do a trial for a piece and I write the piece and I'm brand new. How many names do you test on a new copywriter's package when you start?
Well, in direct mail, our rule of thumb was we did 25,000 name panels because we were trying to back into some way to get about 100 net orders. So that was a way to back into it. Let me just do the math on that so I can check it. But, for example, if you mail 25,000 names and you can get, on a front end, get a 0.25% response rate, that'll give you, we'll say, 625 gross orders, and let's say you can get, I don't know, 30% pay up, that would give you 187 orders. That would be kind of a statistically significant number that you can judge it on. So we backed into the 25,000 name test panel to try to get to a minimum of 100 net orders, so that if the response rates were a little bit lower on the front end or back end, we'd still get 100 net orders. And you would test that 25,000 against a 25,000 similar panel to the control, which is not part of the bulk part of your mailing. Like your bulk mailing, say you were mailing 1 million names, you might mail 800,000 names that all go to the control, and then the other 200,000 could be 8 test panels of 25,000 names each. One of those would be a control panel, and then the other 7 would be tests. And one of those tests would be the hotshot copywriter.
Interesting. So we hear all the time, copywriters hear how important copy is, and certainly it is important, but it's not the whole name of the game. So in Boardroom, talk a little bit about the list selection that these hotshot copywriters, the names that these test panels are going out to. How big of a part does that play in the net results of sales in a marketing of a package?
It's huge. I don't know if it's more than half or 60%. I mean, you know, there's a rule of thumb that says if you mail the best piece of creative of all time and you mail it to a list that's not targeted, not the right audience, not the right people, you'll get no response. If you take a package that's written by a B copywriter or a C copywriter that at least has the basic elements of the offer and what you're offering, and you send it to a list that's psychographically and demographically targeted, you'll get some response. So is that saying that the list is more important? No. What it's saying is that without understanding the list that you're going after, you're making a huge mistake writing copy in a vacuum. So the point for your copywriters on this list, I can tell you that over 30 years of working with the best copywriters alive, ever, who've ever lived, a copywriter who's not interested in the lists I'm mailing, the lists that have worked, the lists that haven't worked, that doesn't ask me for a list history of the product they're working on, I'm almost going to always disqualify them, especially if they're a new writer and they're a writer who thinks they can write a control package not understanding the List universe at all. Now, as far as the test panels themselves, the copywriter has to leave it up to the mailer to figure out how to do the test panels and make sure they do them scientifically correct and make sure that they're demographically similar and that they do the splits right for the test panels and that they're selecting the list properly. It's not the copywriter's job to necessarily select the lists, but to not ask about the lists and the makeup. And you know what? A great copywriter is not only going to get a list history from his client to see what list they're mailing. Once they have that list of lists they're mailing, a good copywriter is going to find out what are the control packages that got those lists or what are the promotions that got those lists. Think about all the things a copywriter could learn about the list they're going after when they can see the people that are on the list and what they responded to previously.
So in some essence, it's really not a level playing field when we're talking about all the copywriters who are writing for control packages, because ultimately it's up to boardrooms and their list management and deciding what...
No, that's not true. No, you didn't understand what I said. It is up to boardroom to have the proper list universe to mail. That's true. So the copywriter has to choose clients who know what they're doing. But it's totally up to the copywriter to, once they choose their client correctly, they're writing a package for a particular list universe that has a control package.
I understand. And they know what list it's going to before they write the package.
I should be asking about that.
Yeah, because that's their market.
That's their market, right. So, yes, if you have a client that doesn't know what the hell they're doing, sure, the copywriter's never going to get a control, and the odds of the mailer being in business for the long haul is slim also. So the question was, you know, kind of the wrong question. The question really is, what can you do as a copywriter to stack the odds in your favor to get a winner? But you're only going to work with clients who understand direct marketing principles.
Can we talk a little bit about the importance of the list, what it looked like in boardroom, and your involvement in the list selection? I mean, that's a huge part of
it. Yeah, it was my lifeblood. I was in the list business for 20 years. That's what I did. So, you know, if you're doing list selection, you want to be able to analyze the list. I mean, what I said before, the promotion that got the name is critical. So through all of my research, whether it's my years in direct mail or currently now when I'm looking at affiliate deals and lists that I want to mail my promotion to online, or my client's promotion online, I want to see, like, what's the promotion that got that name? Like, what kind of approach did they use to bring that list on file? But then beyond that, you need to be a slave to RFM, recency, frequency, monetary, which is the science of list selection. And as true today as it was, you know, 50 years ago. Recency, the R, is how recently have they responded. And the more recent they've responded to something, the hotter the name is. Frequency, how often do they respond? Are they multi-buyers? Are they multi-responders? Do they respond to multiple offers? And monetary, how much did they spend? And what did they spend their money on? So all of those factors, when you're doing list selection, are critical. And again, if you're a copywriter, not understanding RFM, not understanding lifetime value, not understanding these basic concepts, I think puts you at a deficit against other copywriters who understand those things. Because you're writing to people, like, just a simple thing like this. You go to a client and you're going to write a package for them. You need to understand, am I writing to people who bought a product before or not? Am I writing to people who understand this brand that I'm writing under or not? Am I writing to people who are wedded to this brand or product in some way beyond what the new product is? And if I don't understand those basics about who I'm writing to, I'm going to lose. And if I don't write versions of my copy to different list segments, I'm going to lose. I mean, writing to the house list versus the outside list, whether it's online or offline, it's a completely different message. And if I'm a copywriter and I want to get the control, more times than not at boardroom, we had two controls, one for the outside list and one for the house list. Talking to people that knew the boardroom brand or the bottom line brand, and then talking to people who never heard of us before, it's two different copy approaches.
For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com. Is there a lot of fraud in the list rental industry today?
I don't know. I mean, growing up in the list business, there was a lot of trust because you would rent a list for one-time use. I don't think that fraud was rampant. I don't think people would rip off lists indiscriminately. And as a list owner, you know, you weren't going to rent your list to people who you felt might rip you off. So you were very careful, and there were a lot of checks and balances. So the answer is no, but that's why online actually it's easy to protect, because when you're doing affiliate deals or someone is using your list, usually you're doing the mailing of it. So, you know, you can control the messaging to your list, whereas in direct mail you would actually send the list out to somebody and they would do it themselves. But you would decoy your list and you would be able to protect it pretty well.
So if I'm looking at data cards for mailing list to consider a direct mail package I'm going to write, and I'm talking to the list manager, what would you tell one who would be in that situation are some must things as far as research that you should ask that list manager before you decide if it's a list you're willing to invest and test?
Well, there's a lot. I wrote an article years ago called Guilty Until Proven Innocent, and it was actually all about data cards. So you have to read between the lines on a data card. I haven't really looked at a data card for years, but I lived in data cards for 20 years. And so I'll give you a few key things. One is source, you know, where the list come from. So if you can get a list that's all from direct mail and you're selling through direct mail, that's better than people who might have come out through the internet or came through space advertising. And then you also want to see what kind of approach that people use. So I said this before, getting a copy of the list that got the name, whether it was a number 10 package, whether it was a bookalog, whether it was a sweepstakes, how you mail is how they respond.
So what do you ask for? You say, can you please provide me the piece of
copy? The sample mailing piece that got the name of the list that we're renting.
And are most list managers willing to do that?
They should be. I mean, they should be able to get their hands on it. I mean, even if it's a PDF of something, not an actual, they should be able to tell you what it looked like. Yeah, they should. You also want to really ask a lot of questions about recency, frequency, and monetary. You know, how recent are these names? You know, the hotlines, are these last 3 month buyers? Are these last 3 month inquiries? You know, what did they do in the last 3 months? Did they buy? Did they raise their hand? Did they get a free report? Ask a lot of questions about recency. Ask a lot of questions about if they're responding in the last 3 months. Did they buy previously, and are they multi-buyers? Because a multi-buyer select will give you a much higher response rate. And then monitor, what do they spend? You know, if you're a cataloger or someone who has a very high ticket, how much they spend could be a big factor. I mean, those are some of the basic things, but most list managers will try to hide things by saying, you know, 100% direct response generated. Well, what does that mean? Were they generated through direct mail? Were they generated through space ads? All of those things are worth knowing, and usually all of those things you can select on.
Okay. So back to Schwartz. When he was writing packages for Boardroom, can you talk a little bit about what is his own instant improvement company? What was he marketing and selling, and how was that going for him?
Health books, very alternative, a lot of Chinese medicine. They were very small books. If I had to say, they were less sophisticated in terms of their content than what we were selling, what Rodale was selling. But he was able to compete because his promotion was so good. He was able to get the lists, and he was fulfilling a need for people to try a lot of alternative type of medicine, which at the time was state of the art.
He had a stroke as well and lost the use of, was it his left arm or his left hand?
His right, actually. He wrote with his right, and he ended up learning how to write with his left and type with one hand with his left.
Now, when he wrote that piece, Burn Disease Out of Your Body, I forgot the headline, but is it true that he wrote that direct mail letter for that, I'll call him a doctor, because he helped him regain the use of his hand that suffered from the debilitating stroke?
I don't know the whole story behind that. I think he was able to regain a lot based on a lot of things that he did. And so he was one of those guys that was such a lifelong learner and sharer that anything that he experienced, he would share in his copy. So I don't know all the details of that, but I know that there was some truth, obviously, to that.
What does direct mail look like today? Is direct mail dead today because of the internet?
Absolutely not. On the other hand, there's a podcast on my website called Everyone's Going Right, Time to Go Left. And it was an interview with Joe Polish. And what we talked about in that interview was that direct mail is going to get tougher and tougher, and it already is very tough to do acquisition and lead generation as sort of the first step because it's so expensive with postage and printing. On the other hand, there's still people doing it because they're prospecting in a category that's so saturated with online and email that direct mail can really get the attention. But I think where direct mail has incredible incredible power right now is on the back end of an online business. Your listeners here who've listened to me before, and I know you've listened to me before as well, that I think everything's got to be considered in a multi-channel environment. I own the URL, singlechannelmarketingissoboring.com. If you go to singlechannelmarketingissoboring.com, you'll actually redirect to my website. Because I think that being beholden to any one channel is just crazy. So direct mail becomes incredibly powerful on the back end. I mean, when I go to new clients now, I mean, one of the first things I do as a consultant is I really try to pick apart their house list and see what they own, what list do they own. And more times than not, there's a segment of their list that might have been generated initially through the online environment that are spending a lot of money with them that they could actually invest in a major direct mail campaign to sell even a higher priced product. And actually the package itself in a small quantity could be something three-dimensional, could be a book, could be something of tremendous value, because the idea of investing in someone who's already spent a lot of money with you, investing even more money in media called direct mail, you know, direct mail can be mailing 100 pieces as opposed to a million. So when you say, you know, people say direct mail is dead, I think what they're talking about is the hundreds of millions of names that we use to mail. And maybe that piece of the business, if it's not dead, it's certainly on life support, because it's just hard to mail millions of names profitably unless you really know what you're doing. But if you can incorporate the elements of direct mail marketing into everything that you do on the back end of a business, or even if it's on the front end of something that's going to end up being very high ticket in the end, and you have a very targeted list, I think direct mail still has a tremendous viability. But like everything else, it's got to be done with a lot of care, and because it's pricey. But direct mail is not dead. And in fact, I know someone in my mastermind group who is going to build a $100 million business, and the foundation is going to be on direct mail.
That's fantastic. Can you share with me a huge failure that you experienced or witnessed in boardroom, and what was the lesson you learned?
A couple of big ones. One was probably under the heading called Don't Believe Your Press Releases. There's a long story that goes with our launching of an amazing infomercial program on direct response television. And it was in the mid-2000s, and it took me 20 years to figure out how to do infomercials. But when I finally figured it out in the mid-2000s, we went out with 4 out of 5 of our first infomercials all, like, were incredible successes. We think if you looked at the whole infomercial direct response TV franchise and then how it brought back to direct mail and online, it was probably $250 to $300 million over a three-year period.
Was that selling books?
Selling mostly health books. And so when we finally got something to work, a lot of people told me that I got 4 out of 5 to work right away. They said, this is unheard of. The odds for an infomercial working was 1 in 15, maybe 1 in 20. And, of course, you know, I started getting kind of big for my britches, and I started thinking, wow, I got the formula, I know how to do this. And we started doing a bunch of infomercials in different subject areas, trying to use some of the same formula, but kind of branching out. And infomercials were expensive. I mean, you're talking about a very high investment in promotion and development costs, minimum $100,000 to $150,000, but you could spend $1 million, $1.5 million on a show. And the irony is that the media that you go out with to test it is probably $15,000 or $20,000, and then when that doesn't work, you know you're either in or you're out. It's not like direct mail or online where you can start revising and figuring out how to make it work and tweak it. You're dead, basically. You have to start from scratch for the most part. So I would say we probably did 7 or 8 infomercials after those 3 out of 4, and everyone failed. Now, you know, when you have called $200 million cushion to work with, even if each of those 7 or 8 cost me a few $100,000 each, I still probably took, of the $200 million, I probably took about $3 million of it and threw it out the window. And I don't know if I would have done differently, except for the fact that I probably was a little less cautious as I did each one, because I was kind of overly confident that I could produce the same kind of success again. So it's a simple lesson of don't read your press clippings. But also, you know, in marketing, the line between success and failure is so thin. And so really, really not being flippant about any of that is critical. I think another big mistake in my career was as we started moving from offline to online, I made a huge mistake because I was not an expert in online, and yet I wanted to be. I put myself in really good positions. I got myself involved in, probably not fast enough, involved in mastermind groups, involved with people who were kind of doing great stuff online. But I kind of got sold a lot of bill of goods without doing my own due diligence. And it's a classic case of doing what you do best. I like the idea of outsourcing and buying stuff around the corner, but when you buy it around the corner, you still have to make sure that your oversight is still solid, especially if it's the future and you're investing a lot in it. So like a lot of offline publishers, we threw a lot of good money after bad as far as online marketing and web and all that. I mean, I'd say we actually spent less than most because we didn't invest in too much infrastructure. But in retrospect, I think I trusted too many opinions of people that were not as expert as I thought, and that was my fault. So that's a due diligence on what people's real expertise is. And I think there are so many better tools today, both in terms of HR and track record of models that work, that I don't think I would make that mistake again on behalf of a client. But, you know, it was a little bit of wild, wild west, and I probably wasn't as cautious, again, as I should have been. And I trusted the judgment of people who I assumed knew more than me, but they probably didn't. And that was a big mistake on my part.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
All right, with the infomercials, what was the net effect? You had three wins and you had more losses, but did those three wins make up for the investment of all the losses?
Yeah. As I said, the three wins probably were responsible because I added new direct mail to those three wins. I added online marketing to those three wins that they probably accounted for $200 to $300 million somewhere. Each loss was, you know, call it a couple hundred thousand.
And you couldn't really put your finger on or figure out the reason the failures?
I have a saying that I predicted every test that I've ever done in my career with 100% accuracy once I have the results. So once I had the results, it was obvious why each one didn't work. On two of them in particular that I loved, well, one of them I loved, and it was such a good show. I still believe it's a good show, but it didn't work because it was about prevention. Wasn't about cures. And in the health area, it's really very difficult to sell prevention. It's actually difficult to sell prevention in almost anything. And the other one that didn't work was way too comical. We actually tried to inject a lot more humor. And they say in direct mail, humor can't work, or direct marketing, you shouldn't use humor. And I've seen levels of humor work, but this was like too sarcastic, too funny, too much about entertainment, and not about the information, which was very, very serious. And I think at the time it felt great, but then we realized that the information that we're selling is serious. It's life or death. It's health information. So the shows that worked, you know, all had Hugh Downs or some credible news person and, you know, a health editor and experts from the field. So when I took that out, the experts didn't fit well when I threw them in with humor, and they didn't fit in when I fit them in with prevention as opposed to cure. So, yeah, I was able to figure out, like, why. But at the time, as I said, I really felt I had great content. In every case, I had great content to deliver. So this is also another lesson. You think you've got great content, and anybody who gets this content is going to improve their life. Well, great. But how you present it, if it's not congruent with what the consumer really wants, you're going to be paddling upstream.
So when you take some chances on that, and I know it's a team effort, and Marty, would think, is involved in the whole process, but...
He wasn't involved much at all in the infomercial process.
He wasn't. Were you bummed out? Was it stressful when you're losing money like that as an employee for them?
No, it was stressful because I really thought we could get another big winner.
Did you keep trying for that big winner, or did you pretty much say, let's be happy with what we have with those three winners?
No, I kept trying, of course.
Never did you get another big winner, infomercial?
Did not.
All right, so what made you stop?
My doctor, my head hurts. I've been talking my head against the wall, and it hurts. Oh, maybe you should stop banging your head against the wall. But I also saw some signs that were not just about us. I'm not that stupid, but there were some signs that the infomercial business was changing, too. You know, the advent of TiVo at the time and then DVRs. I think the business was changing. That's what kind of moved me out of it as well. But it was really a function of realizing that we had a magical run with a series of products, and then the other products that we thought could work just didn't, and, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. How about with the direct mail pieces? How many losers are there compared to home run or winners? What does that look like for someone who has no clue?
You get, I mean, a winner to me in direct mail, I mean, I want to get at least a 30% lift in response, and it's a very small percentage that get 30% lifts in response. So
clarify on that. What do you mean?
If I have a control that's indexing 100, I want to get at least 130. In terms of my net index. So if I get a net index of 15, I get a 115.
You got to put it in English. These people don't know what net index is.
Okay, so basically what I'm saying is that if I get a 1% response, I want to get at least a 1.3% net response. So in other words, remember we talked about P&L is the most important, so whether they're paying up front or not. So it's 1% versus 1.3. To get a 1.3 is significant from a 1.0. If I get a 1.15, it's still fairly significant, and usually I can get a new control that way. So the times you get a 1.15 or a 1.3, and again, I'm using 1% as my number. It could be 2%, and then I need the 30% would be 2.7. You understand what I'm saying, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not going to get winners like that more than probably 10 or 15% of the time at best. And usually it's because you went out to a new copywriter or a new piece of creative and you did it from scratch. And therefore, you know, you change the game in that particular product. So tweaks, like, you know, changing a headline or changing a cover or changing an outer envelope or changing a subject line in an email, those things, usually they won't get you 30% lifts. They might, but that's very, very rare. That's, like, way less than 10%.
All right, so with each test package, you say it went out to 25,000 names?
In direct mail?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so if you show some promising results with the first test of 25,000 names, what's the next step up with the same package as far as quantity of names, and how do you protect yourself from not losing on that next mailing?
Well, you got to strike while the iron's hot. So you're either going to call it a new control or you're not. So on a list, you want to pyramid slowly. Pyramid meaning the next test. So if it was just a list test, forget creative test for a second. If it was a list test of 25,000 and it worked really well, and there was a million names available on that list, I might only go from 25 to 250,000 on the next one. I'll go like 10 times maybe. If I have a creative panel of 25,000 against another control panel of 25,000 and I get a significant, you know, over a 15% lift, I'm going out with the new package, the 25,000 winner, as the control in the next mailing, which could go out to a million names. What I might do, in addition to that, is do what we call a back test. So a back test would be that I would take the old control and make sure I have a 25,000 name test panel in the next mailing of the old control against the new control of a 25,000 name test panel in addition to all the other tests. So at least I will confirm how much of the list I really got. But I got to tell you, you do a 25,000 name panel for a new piece of creative, get more than a 15, 20% lift in response rate. I don't care how big my mailing is. I will probably roll that new package to the entire list.
Have you lost on something like that?
No.
Never.
No. You get the same. I mean, that would be like the worst, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that people should know, and this is something we did test, and people do, a lot of times they have a thing called double flighting controls. So that, remember I said, I gave you the example of the million piece mailing and you've got 200,000 pieces of test panels. So you got 8 25,000 name test panels. In some cases, we would actually have 2 25,000 panels of the control, like the same, exactly the same. And the reason you do that is that even if you can set the lists up to be demographically similar, a cross section of all the different test panels, we often would see discrepancies between two panels of the same creative package that could be different in response rate by as much as 10 or 15%. That 15% lift is sort of the minimum that you want to go with in order to roll out completely. So what happens is if I've got two control packages in a big mailing, and one does 100 and one does 115, and I have another test panel that's doing 125, is the 125 better than the 115 or better than the 100? And so then I take the 100 and the 115, which are the two identical control packages, call it a 108, and now I think with my 125 test panel, I'm even more confident that I probably have even a bigger winner. But that's why you don't want to roll out without a decent lift. If I only got one test panel that indexed like a 106, like 6% better, that might not be enough for me to roll out to a big mailing with that on the next mailing, because it could have been a 94 as well as it could have been a 106. So there's a lot of explanations, a lot of detail there, except the big issue is you got to believe your numbers and you got to get a big enough lift to say I'm confident that this lift is going to hold up when I roll out.
All right, I want to be respectful of your time. We're going to start wrapping it up. So I want to ask you, why did you leave Boardroom and what are you doing now?
So I spent 34 years helping build the company. When I got to Boardroom in 1981, I said it was about a $3 to $5 million business. Marty and I grew it to $157 million in the mid-2000s. A lot to do with that whole infomercial business that we did. I think our biggest year was $157 million. We were $100 million for a good chunk of the time that I was there. And, you know, I was a partner in the business. I had equity in the business. And I got to a point where I kind of wanted to figure out some other direction for the company. And it's a family-owned business, so I didn't have complete control of what I wanted. And so in a cordial way, I decided that I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do with these particular assets long-term. So I left on really good terms. The family wants the company to go in a little different direction, and that's fine. I wish them well. I still wish them well. I have a lot of friends and people there that I love very much. And so I only left this past year. So in the last year, what I've done with my own business, which is called Titans Marketing, is I've developed my own mastermind group. So I've got a group of right now 23 incredible companies and entrepreneurs who are just really interested in multi-channel marketing, interested in building their business 10x and building their impact 10x even more than their business. So I'm working closely with that group, and that's like my core group of, we'll call it clients, but it's more of a regular mastermind group. And then I've got a lot of consulting clients, a few of which I'm really immersed with, whether I'm on their board, whether I'm have an equity position in the company, or I'm developing an equity position in the company, or I'm on retainer. I also do like hourly type consulting. Like I coach with young entrepreneurs. I also do some consulting where I'll do date rate for certain clients who wanted to spend a full day brainstorming their marketing plan. So I've done a few of those. And then I'm going to create some products. I've got a product that I want to do. Speaking of copywriters, I'm going to do a product with AWAI called Marketing Essentials Every Copywriter Needs to Know. And a lot of the things on this call are things that I'm going to have in that course. Things like copywriters really understanding lists. I mean, I think that's a big, big thing. And I'm glad you asked the question because that's a big thing for me.
What does your mastermind look like? How much is it?
The mastermind is $20,000 a year. I'll never have more than 30 companies in the mastermind because I want to keep it intimate. I have to interview people to get them in. I mean, I interviewed, I think, 40 companies to pick the 23 that I have in now.
And what do they get for $20,000 a year?
It's 3 2-day live meetings. We meet for 2 full days, 3 times a year, and that's hot seats, that's guest speakers, that's presentations from the members. It's a pretty intense 2 days of content, people helping each other with their businesses. It's a pretty good offering. And then the other 9 months where we don't meet are months where we have a phone call, and on those phone calls I have different guest speakers. Then we do like mini discussions on various topics. People can then have office hours with me, so I do one-on-one consulting with people who are in the mastermind when they need it.
Where can one learn more about the mastermind program?
I think people should just email me if they're interested because I have to set them up for an interview.
All right, give your email again.
So they should go to BrianKurtz1@gmail.com, BrianKurtz1@gmail.com. Now, I'm also going to do what I call Titans Master Classes, and those are going to be 2-day events, all hot seats, probably 30 people for 2 full days, and that'll be priced more as like a one-time event, not as a mastermind. So I'm thinking it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000, but maybe a little less. I haven't decided yet for the 2 days, but it'll include, again, a lot of content, potential guests, hot seats for every company who participates. And I did the similar thing at my Titans event, and it was very, very successful. So if people just want to be on my list, they should just go to briankurtz.me, www.briankurtz.me, and they can just opt into my list. I blog there, and, you know, when I decide to do these master classes, I'll probably be talking about them there. And that would be another way for me to connect with people on your list if they're interested in learning more from me without having to join a full-year mastermind.
Now, what if I wanted you for a day, if you would have me? What do you generally get for a day's worth of consulting?
So right now my day rate is $11,000 a day plus travel. I do that on a selective basis because I can't afford to travel as much as I have been. But I like doing that if it's the right company and the right fit. I do Skype calls at $1,000 an hour with a little bit of prep and a little bit of post, but not a lot. On the $11,000 day, that includes prep work, and on the post, where, you know, I really know I can help, is my resources, because I can suggest resources and do stuff on the back end. So it's way more than 11 hours for the $11,000. It's usually about 14 hours or so. So that's the day rate. That's the hourly rate. But, you know, I'm more interested in longer-term relationships, so I love doing retainer agreements. But I like being involved with companies who really want to grow, who really want to move their businesses forward and want to do multi-channel marketing in particular. So that's kind of where my biggest desire is at this point.
I got to ask you this. Are you using any direct mail to help you facilitate new clients and your new
offers? Yes, I do. I do. I'll give you an example. I hosted a dinner in Arizona with some amazing people. I was at Joe Polish's event, and I put together one of my, what I call the boardroom dinners. They're pretty famous. And I put together this 14-person dinner, and after the dinner, I sent an email to everybody, you know, thanking them for coming and gave them a PDF of everybody who was there. But then I sent each one of them an individual note with a book that was written by one of the people who were at the dinner, not asking for anything. But, you know, frankly, that's direct mail.
Yeah.
Those are 14 superstars around the table. I have no idea if I'll ever do business with them. I mean, every one of them, I just want to be friends with the rest of my life.
So you put that together, that dinner?
Yes, with my buddy Richard Rossi, who's in my mastermind. So, yeah, the two of us put it together. But I can do those all the time. I have a PDF, which if you want, you can share with your audience. It's
sure.
called The Boardroom Dinners, and it was a chapter in a book from Rick Frischman called Networking Magic. I think anybody can do them. I mean, to be able to put together dinners of great people.
Didn't I hear Edelstein used to do this with Schwartz, and I remember Schwartz and...
Yeah. Well, Marty invented them, and then we continued them, and yeah, it's a concept that's been out there for a while, and more people should do it.
Wonderful. Well, look, I know you got to go, and we've covered a lot of great information. I really appreciate you taking the time to share all your wisdom and insight, and I'm certain that we're going to be able to introduce you to a few people on my list who never knew about you, and I hope you're able to establish some relationships from the time you've invested with me and my listeners.
That's great. I really enjoyed it.
Brian, have a kick-ass day. Thank you.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye. That's the end of our interview with Brian Kurtz. I hope you found it helpful. And for more great interviews on copywriting, marketing, and advertising, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.